This podcast is brought to you by Workle, a platform helping people get happier at work. Find out more at workle.co. Work happier.
I was part of what became the most successful fund management business in the UK. There were 10 people being interviewed for 6 places or something. And I was the only girl. And I was the only person who hadn't been to Eton. Then I got my feet under the table and realised what a difficult task it was, and I was really quite scared. And the next thing I knew, I ended up with the world's press on my doorstep.
Welcome to the Happy Work Life podcast, where people with inspiring careers reflect on how happy they have been in their working lives. On this podcast, we hear from a range of people working in business, startups, science, academia, media, healthcare, fashion, and much more, and find out which roles gave them the most satisfaction and, importantly, what they have done to get happier at work. So, sit down with me, Mark Price, founder of Workle, to help you get happier at work. Workle is the platform where you can find a job in the happiest companies, take our happiness test, network, and get career support from experts, and much, much more. Welcome to this edition of the Happy Work Life podcast with Nicola Horlick, who many of you will know is a British investment fund manager. She's a merchant banker, and she was dubbed the City Superwoman by the British media. Now, Nicola has had a very long and distinguished career. She was at Morgan Grenfell, then after that, she went to set up SG Asset Management with Société Générale. Then she went on from there to Brandeam Asset Management and set that up, and then she founded a peer-to-peer lending group called Money & Co. in 2013. Nicola is also now chairman of Rockpool Investments, which raises private equity for companies. And she's also a trustee for the Childhood Trust. So, Nicola, welcome to this edition of the podcast. I'd like to start, if I may, with your early life. Was there anything in those early days that made you think that you would have such a successful career in banking? Was that the thing that you always longed to do?
Absolutely not. In fact, I wanted to be an actress, and I spent a lot of my early life acting in school plays and so on, but also going to festivals and doing poetry society exams and all those sorts of things. And I actually applied to RADA at the same time as I applied to Oxford. And I got a place at Oxford, and I went for my audition at RADA, and the principal said to me, "You're a little bit young," because I took my A-levels when I was 17. And he said, "I think you should take up your place at Oxford, do lots of acting, and then come back to RADA." So I went to Oxford, did lots of acting, and then weirdly, somehow ended up in the city. And that was partly because I then met Tim, who's the father of my 6 children, at Oxford. And he was applying to merchant banks, and I didn't actually know what a merchant bank was. And we didn't have the internet, and we didn't have summer internships. We had a careers library, which was pretty bad because everybody had nicked things out of the files. So there was hardly anything there. So I didn't really know what I was applying for. So I applied, and I then got a place, a graduate traineeship at Warburg's, which at the time was the number one merchant bank in the City of London. And everybody was aghast that I, you know, this person who was going to be an actress had suddenly got this place, you know, the most coveted job at that time. So I accepted it and I was delighted to get it, but I really didn't know what I was going to do or whether it would suit me or not.
And tell me, what do you think it was about you that that made them want to offer you the job, given that you knew nothing about merchant banking, as you say, and it was a completely different environment to the one you thought you might go to?
Well, I think actually being a woman is good because it makes you stand out. I mean, I went to final interviews at Barings and Rothschilds and Warburg's. And at Barings and Rothschilds, there were 10 people being interviewed for 6 places or something. And I was the only girl. And I was the only person who hadn't been to Eton or Winchester. Yeah. And all of us had been to Cambridge and Oxford. When I went to Warburg's, it actually was very different in that there were far more women being interviewed. There were a much larger number of people being interviewed. And actually, people came from all over the world. There were people from Denmark and Canada and all sorts of far-flung places. And it wasn't just people who'd been to Oxford and Cambridge and Eton and Winchester. So it was a different environment, and I don't really know what made me stand out. I've always been very forthright, and because I was going to be an actress, I think maybe I was quite good at interview. I probably came across as being quite self-confident, and that is important when you're being interviewed, aren't you? Having now, over the years, interviewed an awful lot of people myself. But on the other hand, you've got to be careful, because if you're too self-confident, then people think you're arrogant. So it's a very fine line.
And so what I think people will have deduced so far from what you've said is that you were clever, you sat your A levels early, you got into Oxford, which is fantastic, you had really good acting skills, so you were personally self-confident, and that you had no preconceived idea about what career you were going to take, but were influenced by Tim, as you said. So I don't know if many people will follow that random path. Let's go to that first stage. You've gone to Warburg. You're there as a graduate trainee. It's your first day. What did you think when you actually walked through the door and started your career as a merchant banker? Did you think I found heaven, or did you think, oh, I'm not sure I've made the right choice here?
No, I actually embraced it, and I was very excited about it once I sort of had a vaguer idea about what it was I'd let myself in for. And we were in a not very nice 1960s building in the city, so it wasn't great surroundings. But I was on a floor with a whole lot of fund managers. I was assigned to a fund manager to be his assistant, even though I had zero qualifications to be his assistant, and I had to learn from him. And he was very good. He was very good at telling me how things worked and so on. We were then sent off on a course, a residential course, to the London Business School. And we had to stay there for a couple of weeks so that we could actually learn more about how markets worked and so on. And I found that really interesting. And although I was going to be an actress, I did double maths at A level. So obviously I was very numerate. But also, I've always been good at writing. So we had to do a lot of writing notes about companies. And I found that really interesting. And very early on, I was told you can go and visit companies, not, BP or whatever, or Unilever, but small companies where no one else ever went to visit them. So I, actually met a stockbroker on a train when I was coming back down to London, having been home for the weekend to Cheshire. And this guy used to give me all sorts of interesting ideas about stocks we might look at, and used to take me on company visits. So we'd go off to Birmingham together and look at a few, steel companies or steel companies that made things out of bits of steel, and all sorts of obscure companies. Like there was one in Lincoln that made peat, or bagged peat, for the gardening industry and seeds and things like that. So I got to know all sorts of little companies doing interesting things, and I used to then write notes about them. And then when eventually Warburg's decided that it was going to launch its UK Small Companies Unit Trust, I was the obvious person to ask to be the manager of it, because I was the one who knew lots and lots about small companies. So I found all of that really fascinating.
And for those that are listening to this who are thinking about, should I have a career in banking, etc., just explain what that job involved.
Well, banking is a very, very broad term that can mean an awful lot of different things. And although I worked in a bank, I wasn't really a banker. I was actually managing money for people. So that might be a pension fund or a charity or a foundation, or it could be individuals, either directly or through unit trusts. So what I was doing was managing money, which is not banking as such. So banking can mean all sorts of different things. Under the auspices of a bank, there are all sorts of different activities that go on. So, for example, corporate advice. So that's not banking as such. So yeah, corporate advice is not banking as such, but it comes under the auspices of investment banks. So a lot of these banks do lots of different things, issue bonds, trade securities, things that aren't traditional banking, but they will also have a banking license and some banking clients, and they do lend money, but often that's actually quite a small part of what they do. So banking can mean an awful lot of different things, in fact.
And so your role when you set up this unit was to invest money on other people's behalf.
I was part of what became the most successful fund management business in the UK. So Warburg's fund management business grew very, very strongly. It then changed its name to Mercury Asset Management. It then eventually was spun out of Warburg's and floated on the London Stock Exchange. So it was a huge success story. And then I was headhunted to go to its arch rival bank, Morgan Grenfell, who were very, very strong as a bank and in things like corporate finance, but they were very weak in my area, fund management. And in fact, their business was really about to die at the point that I was recruited. And I was recruited, in fact, to help turn it around. So that was a very exciting prospect, I thought. When it came to it, it was a bit more difficult than I thought it would be.
And tell me, what skills do you think you need to have to be successful in that area? Because you were clearly hugely successful to be headhunted in the way that you were, to have built the business in the way that you described. So, what are the characteristics that somebody needs to be really successful?
Well, when you're managing people's money, you're measured against the index. So, usually the All Share Index in the UK. So, my job was to beat that index. And that means having a very clear view of which sectors are likely to do well over the coming months, which stocks are likely to do well. And so, you have to do a huge amount of reading, research, meet companies, talk to them, talk to stockbrokers and analysts about which companies are likely to do best over the coming months. And then when it comes to it, there are two things I think that are really important. One is judgment. Some people consistently get it wrong, some people consistently get it right. In fact, most people don't ever get it right all the time. So you're going to get it wrong sometimes, but you need to be getting it more right than wrong. And then the other thing is that you have to be very decisive because you can't say, on the one hand, this stock might be a buy, on the other hand, it might be a sell, because then you're never going to do anything. You have to say, I believe in this stock and I'm going to buy it, or I feel that this stock has run its course and I need to sell it now. And if you're not decisive and you're a ditherer, then you can't be a successful fund manager.
But if everybody's got the same access to the same information and the same advisors, etc., what how come some are better than others? Why are some more successful than others?
It's amazing how everybody can have the same information and come to different conclusions. They say it's just the case that people do come to different conclusions. So, you might have the wrong premise. You might be saying, I think that the economy is going to slow down and go into recession, and then it doesn't, and then certain stocks do better. There are some stocks which are very cyclical, like house builders, for example. So, if your premise is the economy slowing down and it's going into recession, you would then sell the house builders. If that turns out to be the wrong premise, then the house builders actually might do quite well and you made a mistake in selling. So, it's amazing how you can have different people. I mean, look at the Brexit debate, for example. There are an awful lot of people in the City of London arguing for Brexit, which shocked me deeply. I couldn't understand it because it didn't make any sense to leave the world's largest free trade area with 500 million of the world's richest people. How can that make any sense whatsoever? And yet there were people arguing till they were blue in the face, leading fund managers and leading bankers saying this was a good idea. And yet we all had the same information, which was this was actually going to be to the detriment of the UK economy. And, as it is proving to be right now, But I mean, I just can't, to this day, I can't understand how they could ever have argued that.
So if decisiveness is a key quality, what other key qualities would you say somebody needs to have to be successful? Because you've just described a whole group of people there who thought something was right when self-evidently it couldn't be.
They still make money, a lot of them, though, because they
Yeah.
shorted sterling.
Yeah.
I
So
shorted sterling.
tell us about how that works.
How you short something, right? So you can, in the markets, you can sell something that you don't own. You can only do that if somebody who does own it is prepared to lend it to you to cover your position. And a lot of pension funds and big institutions do this. They lend their assets out to people who want to short them. Now, I've never understood it because it seems to me absolutely crazy to be lending your asset to somebody who wants to destroy the price of it for a tiny fee. And I used to say to my clients, please don't do this. Please do not do stock lending, which is the term that covers this. And if we didn't have any stock lending, you wouldn't be able to have any short positions. But anyway, there are people stupid enough, in my view, to lend their assets. And that means that if there are people who think Marks and Spencer's results that are due next week are actually going to be much worse than everybody expects, so I'm going to short that stock, so I'm going to sell it, even though I don't own it, they then borrow the stock from somebody else to cover that position. If then, on the day, the share price collapses, they make money. If, on the other hand, they get it wrong, and actually the results are better than expected and the share price soars, they've lost money. So it's like the reverse of buying something, but it's quite dangerous because, in fact, the downside, if you buy something for a pound, all you can lose is a pound. If you sell something for a pound and it goes up to £20, you've lost £19. So it's not a mirror image. It's a really dangerous activity, shorting. And a lot of people have actually lost a fortune over the years shorting things. But on this particular instance, when it came to Brexit, there were people who were arguing for it, bunging money to the Leave campaign, shorting Sterling behind the scenes. And then, of course, when Leave won, Sterling collapsed and they made a fortune. And that makes me more angry because it's at the expense of our entire country.
Yeah, thank you very much for explaining that to our listeners. And if we go back now to you being headhunted for Morgan Grenfell, you must have felt pretty good being headhunted, having been so successful. Now here you are going to the arch rival being courted. So tell me about that. Tell me about those early days there.
I actually felt really scared. So, yeah, I definitely suffered from a bit of imposter syndrome because I arrived and suddenly I was faced with this terrible mess and I was the person expected to try and sort it out. And I arrived also on a very unfortunate day. It was the day that Gorbachev was basically sort of hustled off by some communists who were trying to, in effect, depose him. And markets were collapsing left, right and centre. And all my new colleagues totally ignored me because, of course, there was this crisis going on and they had to decide what to do with our portfolios. And so no one took any notice of me whatsoever, really, for 2 or 3 days. And then eventually they said, oh, hi, you're here. And then I got my feet under the table and realised what a difficult task it was. And I was really quite scared, I have to say. You know, so this was 1991, so I was 30 years old and I was taking on a business that was in serious trouble.
And did it feel different culturally there? Was it, because you said that Warburg, when you first went there, was quite woman-friendly. Did this feel more like the old school?
It was terrible compared to Warburg's. Warburg's, we all sat in open plan at Morgan Grenfell. In fact, they had started sitting in open plan in my area, but in other parts of the bank, they all had big wood panelled offices. They had a director's dining room, which I made a point of never going to because I felt that was appalling. And they just, yes, it had a very unprofessional feel compared to Warburg's. So there was no proper library, for example. You know, I've explained that we have to do huge amounts of research in my industry. And in those days, we didn't have the internet. We were reliant on paper files and they didn't have a library. They didn't have any information. If I wanted to know what was going on with Unilever, I would have to ring up a stockbroker and ask them, could you send me some notes? And, you know, I would have to apply to the company in writing to ask for the last report and accounts and so on. And it was terrible. So that one of the first things I did was to set up a library and employ a librarian and start stocking our files so that if I wanted to know something about a company, I had that information. There were also these things called Excel cards, which weren't cards. They were sort of like pieces of paper folded up. And they had a lot of information about a company, right down to the smallest companies in the stock market. So I subscribed on behalf of the business for those and made sure that we had those, that they were properly filed, that we could go and look at them whenever we needed to, so that we could get a quick outline of what the company did and where it was financially. So there was a lot that I had to change to turn the business around.
And would you say that, obviously, putting the library in is a physical thing and it's about knowledge. Culturally, were there things that you wanted to change?
Yes. So the other thing was there was a lot of going out for lunch, for long hours out at lunch, people drinking at lunchtime, which wasn't allowed at Warburg's. It actually said in the staff handbook at Warburg's, you will not drink alcohol at lunchtime. And you could always tell the person who was representing Warburg's at company lunches, because in those days it was very old-fashioned. You go to a stockbroker's offices, they would have a large dining room, and you would have maybe 10 or 12 people sitting around a table. And then you would have the chairman, the chief executive, and the finance director of a major company like, BHS or Next or whatever, company it was. And you would sit down to a four-course lunch with lots of alcohol. And the only people not drinking at the table would be the person from Warburg, So since I don't really drink anyway, it didn't bother me. But when I got to Morgan Granville, they were all having, I mean, at these lunches, they would give you sherry beforehand, then they would give you white wine with the starter, red wine with the main course, and then they would pass around port and liqueurs. And this is in the middle of a working day. I mean, it was ridiculous. So I said immediately, well, I'm sorry, none of you are allowed to drink when you go out because it affects your judgment. You can't then come back having drunk all that alcohol and start buying and selling stocks in the stock market for your clients. So anyway, yes, culturally, it was very, very different.
How did that go down, Nicola?
Well, I think because the business was doing so badly, they embraced everything that I suggested with great enthusiasm, surprisingly. There were one or two people who didn't, but most of them did. And I gave them a vision. I said, this is how we're going to do it, and this is where we're going with this business. And I had two people from Warburg's who came with me as well. So that helped reinforce it. And amazingly, the business turned around very quickly and went from being the worst performing fund management company in London to the best.
And in the end, you fell out with them. So
Yeah, but that wasn't really, I mean, it was a very unexpected event, which involved a fund manager who had also come from Warburg's but did not report to me. He was in a different bit of the business. And he turned out to be a crook, basically a fraudster. And he set up some vehicles and created a terrible financial mess, which resulted in our flagship unit trust, which was our European unit trust. Suddenly, instead of being worth 1.5 billion, turned out to only be worth 900 million or something. So there was suddenly this huge, massive black hole. And, these merchant banks weren't very large compared to the banks of today. And their balance sheets were actually quite small, and bearings had gone bust. And Morgan Granville would have gone bust as a result of this scandal if it hadn't been for the fact that we were owned by Deutsche Bank, who then bailed us out. But what it meant was that my boss, who was in overall charge of the whole of the fund management business, I was in charge of the UK bit, he was sacked, even though he couldn't possibly have known what this guy was doing. And I was the sort of heir apparent, so I should have then been put in charge, but I was on maternity leave when this happened. And so they then brought somebody in from a different bit of the bank who was not a fund manager to manage the business. And I initially thought, well, I've always got on really well with him. I'm sure it'll be fine. And I came back early from maternity leave to help him. And I don't know, the problem was because he didn't know anything about the business and because people didn't know him, they came to me rather than him if there was an issue. And he very quickly got very fed up with this and sort of had his guns out for me. He then accused me of trying to leave and take a team of people to another bank. In fact, I had been approached by that bank and asked if I'd like to go there, and I'd said no. So, actually, I hadn't done anything wrong. And he then suspended me from my job. And the next thing I knew, because I was a woman, age 36 at this point, who had a very high profile in the city, mainly because I was a woman, and also had five children, one of whom had leukemia. As a result, this became a massive story in the press. It was also January, so there wasn't much news. And it didn't just become a UK story, it became an international story. I ended up with the world's press on my doorstep. I lived in a terraced house with no rear access, so I couldn't get out of the house. And it just became this massive thing, which was slightly bizarre. It was like being in a movie, really, living through it.
And when you look back on that now, how do you feel about it many years on?
Well, it was unfair, and things that are unfair make me angry. So I went to see the top employment barrister at the time, who is now Lord Faulkner in the House of Lords, used to be Tony Blair's, great supporter. And he said to me, "Look, clearly you've been wronged, but my advice to you is to just go home and wait for the phone to ring because it will." So I took his advice and I went home, and the phone did ring. It actually rang 28 times in total. And I joined forces with my old boss, who'd been sacked over this scandal, even though it wasn't his fault. And we went through all these different options that we had, and eventually it came down to two. One was an American bank, one was a French bank, and in the end we chose the French bank because they were prepared to give us equity in the business.
And that was when you set up SG Asset Management, which again was fantastically successful.
It was much more successful, much faster than anybody anticipated. So the French then bought us out early, and that then allowed me to go and set up my own fund management business,
So then it was to Bramdean Asset Management.
which
And
still
then
exists.
after that, just to set out the amazing track record you have for our listeners, then after that, Money and Co. So, I mean, you had such an amazing and successful career in merchant banking. I mean, it's been phenomenal, Nicola.
Well, yeah, I think luck plays a role in everybody's careers. So I probably was in the right place at the right time. And also, it was the boom years for fund management. It was the glory years. And it's not such an exciting place to be anymore because there were various legislative changes that Gordon Brown made that resulted in the pension fund industry, which was really the core of the fund management industry in the UK, changing very significantly. And now an awful lot of it is, they use tracker funds, so they just buy the index. They don't have people like me going and seeing companies and trying to decide which company to buy. And also, they use a lot of government debt instead of equities now. Instead of buying shares, they just have UK government debt or US government debt, which they then match to the liabilities. So they say, right, well, in 20 years' time, we're going to have to pay this much out. So we're going to buy a whole lot of 20-year bonds. And they just leave it there. So it's not, and it now it's not nearly as exciting as it used to be. So I was really lucky in terms of timing that I happened to be in the city, in that particular bit of the city, at a really exciting time.
So if somebody was to say to you or to ask you, would you advise that their 21-year-old went into the city, went into banking, what would you say now?
I mean, there are lots of interesting things you can do in banking. I think it's still an interesting industry. And quite a few people, it depends which bit you're going into, but the sort of glamorous bit is corporate advisory and corporate finance, which is now subsumed into these huge investment banks, the big US banks like Goldman's and Morgan Stanley. And I think my advice to anyone wanting to do that is to qualify first as either an accountant or a solicitor, because there's a lot of technical work involved in that type of industry. It's very transactional and very technical. And so becoming an accountant or a solicitor first is a good thing to do.
And do you think that culturally the city has changed? Is it different working there now than it was when you started?
Yes, because when I started, the broking firms were partnerships and the merchant banks were small and quite often had families involved in them, like Warburgs and the Barings and the Rothschilds and so on. And now these financial institutions are massive and employ tens of thousands of people, so it's a wholly different atmosphere. And in some ways, it makes it a less enjoyable atmosphere, I would say. There's more politics that goes on. And the rewards are so great that people will stab anyone in the back to try and get to the top. So it can be a very unpleasant environment. So people need to be strong and need to be able to stand up for themselves. And you need to learn. I think one of the most important pieces of advice I can give to anybody going into one of these organizations is, that you need a sponsor. And there is a difference between a sponsor and a mentor. A mentor is someone who sort of gives you a bit of advice about how you might conduct your career. A sponsor is someone who sits around the table at promotion time and argues for you to be promoted. And you need, and one of the reasons I was successful in the city is I recognized that. No one had ever taught me this. I just sort of realized it very early on. And I made sure that I had sponsors who had power and could argue for me.
Good advice. And can we just touch on your book? You wrote a book in 1998 now called Can You Have It All? So my question to you is, can you have it all?
No, that's why I wrote the book. Because when I had this whole debacle with Morgan Granville and I was suddenly over in every newspaper in the world virtually, I got really cross that I was often referred to in those articles as the girl who had it all. And the reason I got cross about that was because my eldest daughter had leukemia. And I thought, how can anyone say I've got it all when I've got a child who's got leukemia? And actually, that very year that I published that book, she died at the end of that year. So, you know, it made me cross because it sort of infers that being successful in your career and being paid well for doing your job is the be-all and end-all, and it's not. And yes, okay, it's great to be successful in your job and it's great to be paid lots of money, but at the end of the day, I would exchange all of that for Georgie's life. You know, I'd rather have Georgie, obviously, than all the success I had in my career. And so that was the point I was trying to make in that book, was that I don't have it all. I don't have Georgie's health. And that is the most important thing to me of all.
And touching on the six children that you had back in those days, how did you feel about the balance between having a large family and a career in the city? Because a lot of people called you supermum, didn't they? Because what they were saying is you did an amazing job at juggling a hugely successful career with having a large family. So, I mean, what are your views on that in terms of having it all, the family and the incredibly successful life in the city?
Well, the thing is, if I'd been doing corporate finance or investment banking, which involves incredibly long hours and being there all weekend when you're doing a transaction, I wouldn't have been able to have all those children. Well, I could have had all those children, but I would have had several nannies probably looking after them. But because I was doing fund management, and what's more, I was a UK fund manager, that meant that I had to be there very early in the morning. I had to be at my desk by 7:15 in the morning, but I could leave at 5:30. Because the market closed at 4:30. So that meant I was always home by 6:30 at night. And actually, you know, by the time the children had got home, had their supper, done their homework, and been to some after-school clubs and so on, they probably hadn't been at home for terribly long by the time I got back. So, and I always read to them every single night. We would have 5 stories when they were young enough. And then as they got older, you know, the older ones would read themselves and I would end up reading to the younger ones. And then I accepted very few invitations to go anywhere during the week so that I was there in the evenings. I didn't travel for work because I was UK based. And then at weekends, we went to the country, to our house in the country, and it was all about the children and riding and swimming and playing tennis and whatever. So, you know, I think you've got to be sensible. If you take on a job that actually isn't normal working hours and runs into weekends, I think that makes it very difficult to also be a parent, never mind to 6 children, to 1 child, you know, and you just have to accept that there are certain boundaries in terms of, you know, how you divide your life.
And in terms of what you're doing now, you've not retired. You're still working hard. You're still in merchant banking. You're a chair. So interesting to hear about that move now to chairing. And also you're heavily involved in a charity, so which I've already explained at the introduction. But do you want to say a few words about that as well, Nicola?
Yeah, so I chair Anthony Nolan, which is the charity that runs the biggest register in the UK for stem cells and bone marrow. And this obviously goes back to the fact that Georgie, my daughter, had leukemia. And in fact, she had to have a bone marrow transplant. And the donor actually came from the Anthony Nolan Register. So when they approached me a few years ago and asked me if I'd be interested in being the chair, I said, well, yes, because obviously I've got a connection. Even though she didn't survive, ultimately, I was very, very grateful to them. And I wanted to try and help other people with a better chance of survival. So I accepted, but I am not used to being a chair. I'm used to being the CEO, and there's a marked difference between those two roles. And I was thinking to myself, I've got to be really careful here not to interfere with what the CEO is doing. But I think actually it's been a lot easier than I thought it would be. And you know, the role of the chair is, in a charity like that, is to make sure you've got the best trustees, to make sure that you know how the trustees are feeling, and try and make sure they give their best commitment that they can, and that they're, you know, giving input. So some people will have different skills. Some people might be very good at fundraising. Some people might have IT skills, which are useful to the charity. Some people, you know, might have, in this case, medical knowledge, which is useful to the charity, biotech and so on. And you know, my job is to make sure that we've got the right mix of people. Diversity also is another thing. We're in London, so you know, we have a very diverse population, making sure that we aren't just all stale and white and so on and so forth. So you know, that's the role of the chair. And I found it a lot easier, I suppose, actually, to be a chair than I thought I would find it, because I thought, you know, I'm so used to being a CEO. So that's the difference. And yeah, it's a fantastic charity. It's very large, you know, compared to most charities. It's got a very large income. And it's in some ways more of a business than a charity, which is why they were interested in me being the chair.
And my last question, sort of career-wise, is you had a brush with politics in 2019. How did you find that?
Yeah, so I stood as the Liberal Democrat candidate for Chelsea and Fulham because I was trying to stop Brexit. You know, at that stage, we'd had the Brexit vote in 2016, but there was still a chance that we could have a second referendum. And clearly, the Lib Dems were, you know, leading the charge in terms of trying to get people to agree that we should have a second referendum and to accept that it was a mistake to decide to leave. I actually have always been a Liberal Democrat. My father was on the executive committee of the Liberal Party before it merged with the SDP. And he stood for Parliament three times, twice in general elections and once in a by-election. And he'd been a councillor. My mother had stood as a councillor and so on. They were both governors of schools and all that sort of thing. So I was brought up with all of that. And I was brought up sticking leaflets through doors. And so I thought, well, if I stand in the general election as a Lib Dem and try and make a thing about Brexit, maybe that would be a good idea to try and help stop it. And I did very well in that. In the previous election in 2017, the Conservatives had won the seat and Labour had come second and the Lib Dems were a poor third. And in 2019, I came second, so I pushed Labour into third, but Greg Hand still won. He was the incumbent MP and he remained. So, in fact, in the last election, he lost to Labour by 132 votes or something. So, it's very much a three-way constituency. But I'm still the chair of the Hammersmith and Fulham Liberal Democrats, and we will be fighting the council elections in 2026 and, you know, hoping to win some seats.
And do you think you might stand for Parliament again?
Definitely not. As I said, really, that was just a sort of try and stop Brexit thing.
And so, if you're not doing enough already, how about the future? Is there anything in particular that you're thinking about doing in the future?
Well, I also have a film business, believe it or not. And I'm working on a production at the moment. I think that we've secured the funding for it, and it will go in to production next year. And one or two of my other films have been made, but this will be quite a big film. And that will be very gratifying because it's something I've been working on for a long time. And I've got a production partner in the US, but it's a UK film. So it will be filmed here, and hopefully we'll get a stellar cast. It will have a sizable budget, and you know, with a fair wind, it could even win awards because it's a really good story.
And can you give us any clue?
It's about a gang, some gangsters in London in the 1960s, but they were women, not men. And it's based on a true story.
Wow. And when do you think that might be out?
Well, if it's filmed next year, in the first half of next year, generally it takes 2 years from when you wrap through to when it's actually on screens. So early 2028, I would say.
Now, one thing that all our listeners will want to know, Nicola, is given your acting pedigree and early life aspirations, will you have a role in the film?
I think it's highly unlikely. I might be an extra because
A cameo. Richard Branson managed to get himself into a James Bond film. So
it's quite boring, you know, because I mean, honestly, I was an extra. My husband and I were extras in one of our other films, which was filmed in Puerto Rico. And it was a wedding scene. And we had to stand up, sit down, listen to the same words being said over and over again, because they have to film everything from different angles. And it's tedious in the extreme, I can't tell you, being on a film set. It's not as glamorous as people think. But I don't know. Yeah, maybe I could have a little cameo role somewhere.
Well, Nicola...
No one has suggested that so far, though.
Well, Nicola, we'll all look forward when the film comes out to trying to spot you somewhere or another. But thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me and to share with our listeners your amazing career and all you've achieved. And we all wish you every success in the future. Thank you.
Thank you.
To listen to more episodes and find out how to get happy in your working life, head to workall.co. Work happier.